Welcome to Mumble Jumble, where we talk about ideas with people that make the world go round. I'm your host, William Yuen Yi. Dr. Seamus Khan is a professor and chair of the Department of Sociology here at Columbia University. He writes about elites and inequality in American culture, and his work has been featured in numerous international media outlets like Time Magazine, The New York Times, and CNN, just to name a few. He graduated from St. Paul's School in 1996 and returned later as a faculty member for 1 year to conduct a study of his alma mater. The result, of course, was the publication of the book Privilege, The Making of an Adolescent Elite at St. Paul's School, which is what we're going to talk about today. He also recently published a book this past January with fellow Columbia professor Jennifer Hirsch called Sexual Citizens, which takes a novel look at the issue of sexual assault on college campuses. Professor Khan, thank you so much for joining me on the show today to talk about your experience at St. Paul's and your book, Privilege.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, yeah, I guess I'll start off with what inspired you to write the book, Privilege?
It was a range of things that I was interested in. I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin, which is kind of this home of stratification research or research on patterns of inequality. And there were sort of three things that really struck me as important and sort of missing from the conversation. The first was that we normally think about inequality relationally. So you don't think about inequality as like the property of poor people. You think about it as a relationship that the poor are in with a society and with other people. So the insight there is that, like, you know, we don't want to look at how inequality works by just looking at like what particular people are like, but instead to see how they're relating to others. But if that's the case, we had very little work on rich people or sort of the other side of inequality. And so that was the first thing. The second was actually this economics paper that came out in 2003, which was about the rising incomes of rich people. And this is super well known now. But at the time, it was kind of shocking. And so this was the work of Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, who wrote a paper in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, basically showing that like inequality was being driven by rich people getting richer, especially since, you know, sort of the 1970s. And then the third thing was in my own home area of sociology, I was interested in the work of a guy named Pierre Bourdieu, who's a French sociologist who works on basically like elites and cultural dynamics. And so, you know, I thought about these three things together, about how we think about inequality relationally, but we don't have a lot of work on rich people, how rich people are probably driving inequality for the last 40 years at least, and how there's this sort of like other world of research out there outside of the United States. And I thought, oh, I could combine these things together and do a project on inequality by looking at elites or rich people.
So what's interesting is you mentioned the second point, rich people getting richer, and that's been happening, you know, for decades now. But what's also been happening for decades, coincidentally, is you mentioned this in the book. In 1951, black people composed just 0.8% of students at elite colleges. And the Columbia College class of 2014 was 13% black. And every year, it seems that these elite institutions are increasingly embracing diversity. How do you, I guess, explain that contradiction there?
Yeah, so this is sort of the point of the book, is that we normally think about inequality as being the product of exclusion. And so, you know, there's been huge increases in inequality since about 1971, 1972, but it'd be pretty hard to describe American society as much more exclusive over that time. So you pointed to racial exclusions that were really predominant in the 1950s and 60s, and obviously well before then. Another example would be gender. I mean, if you look today at colleges and universities, there's a huge gender gap, but the gender gap is in favor of women. And so, you know, these institutions are clearly much more open to women. They're clearly much more open to racial and ethnic minorities. And there's sort of two ways that I think about that. The first is class still matters. So the economic basis of inequality really, really matters. And while institutions, organizations, societies more generally has opened up racially and in terms of gender, class dynamics are still sort of really present in America and often really invisible. So that's sort of the first thing that I would think about. But that the second is more sort of a conceptual idea, which is that it could be the case that openness and inequality go together. So that increases in inequality aren't just when societies are sort of closed off, but actually can happen under conditions of being opened up. And so one of the main conceptual points of the book is thinking about what I call democratic inequality, or the ways in which more open institutions can at times facilitate increases in inequality, not decreases in inequality.
And so you're saying that's because these class dynamics and gaps exist within the institutions themselves?
It can be for a wide range of reasons. One of the main ones I point to in the book is class, but there are other reasons as well. So, for example, open institutions could lead to things like massive rates of growth. And through massive rates of growth, you could have very inequitable transformations. So that if the growth is disproportionately placed among a small group of people, then you'll have massive rises in inequality, whereas very closed systems may actually be really stagnant. Thinking about this and balancing out the relationship between openness and closure, growth, inequality, are things that I think help us have a conversation about the problems of inequality in ways that aren't so facile as being like closed systems create inequality, open systems create equality. And we begin to see the dynamics of inequality and, importantly, something quite different, mobility, in different ways.
So we've been talking about some of the finer points that you make in the book. I guess for people who haven't read it, can you just briefly summarize the key arguments you make in this book? I mean, you talk about three characteristics of the new elite.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I'll even take a bigger step back and say, like, what the book is based on.
So sure.
It's a study of St. Paul's School, which is sort of a very elite boarding school in Concord, New Hampshire, which I attended as a student and then went back to teach at for a year. And so the book is an ethnographic study, which means basically I hung out at the school and I wrote about what I saw. So very kind of anthropological in its tradition. And while I was there, I sort of lived in a dormitory. I advised students. I taught a series of classes. And I wanted to see the sort of changing nature of American inequality, how things were sort of shifting in these elite institutions, which were opening up in really important ways and yet sort of central to the production of elites or wealthy people. And, the book begins with a story of like my own time as a student there and encounters where I basically lived in a dorm that was filled with minority students. This was something the school wasn't particularly proud of at the time, but it was something that kept reappearing. As much as the school tried to get rid of it by distributing minority students across a range of dorms, there was a dorm for girls and a dorm for boys that were sort of predominantly minority student dorms. And in the opening of the book, one of the things I note is that like that dorm no longer existed at St. Paul's when I went back. The idea that people were racially clustered no longer existed. But there was a kind of clustering that still happened. And the clustering that still happened were people who I describe as being entitled. And so the argument of the book is this idea of a shift between or from entitlement to privilege. And entitlement is the idea that like you belong at St. Paul's because your family's always gone there, because you're from the right kind of family, because you have ties to that institution. It's a logic of what I call like class, that your association with other people, with institutions, with a particular part of American history should matter and should be rewarded. And I argue that like those people actually are increasingly isolated at St. Paul's. People who kind of like project that air of entitlement are dismissed. But that there's, you know, a kind of more predominant logic now of privilege. And the idea of privilege is that like you're elite because you work really hard, you're really smart, and you achieve a lot through your own doing. And that so much of schools today from like, you know, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia, St. Paul's, Exeter, Andover, Lawrenceville are places that really reward the logic of privilege, which is a logic of like I'm super successful because of what I've done. And a lot of what I talk about in the book is that most people are not successful because of what they've done. They're successful because typically they are born into rich families, but for other kinds of reasons. And that there are lots of people who've done a lot who don't end up with these kinds of advantages. And so I kind of want to uncover why that's the case.
Yeah. So I guess that point is really interesting, this idea that kids And you mentioned this in the book, like at St. Paul's, the best person at a certain activity is automatically assumed to be the best person in the world at that activity. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, what's the problem with that
logic?
Sure.
I mean, you know, there's something quintessentially adolescent about this, you know, so it's not just St. Paul's, but it certainly is where, you know, the best kid at a high school who's really good at chess is like the world's greatest chess player. Yeah. The best kid at the violin happens to be like, you know, destined to go to Carnegie Hall, or, you know, the best kid at math is going to win some kind of prize. And, you know, the issue with this is that, like, you know, let's just take Columbia as an example. So, you know, there's a huge increase in financial aid at places like Columbia, places like Harvard. But, you know, the head of admissions at Harvard considers middle income to be around $200,000 a year for familial income. And, you know, the average family in the United States makes around $60,000. I mean, this would put you in the top 5%, you know, not far away from the top 1%. Of earners. And so huge portions of classes at places like Columbia, Harvard, Yale, Princeton still come from the sort of most advantaged families, either in terms of wealth or in terms of income. And we need to ask ourselves why that is the case, and also sort of not function under the fiction that those people are in the positions they're in because they're super talented. They may be talented, but they've had huge investments put in them in comparison to other young people.
So on the topic of, I guess, schools like Columbia, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, one of the arguments for, I guess, one of the reasons people, these wealthy families want to send their kids to prep schools like St. Paul's is because it increases their chances of getting into a good college. And you mentioned this, at St. Paul's, 30% of graduating classes attend an Ivy League school, and around 80% of the class attends one of the top 30 colleges in the nation. Do you think that's fair? What do you make of that statistic?
So, you know, it's not that the students are, like, untalented. You know, we can think about this, like, in a really crass way. So imagine a kid is, like, an investment vehicle, right? So it's, like, and you can pour money into it, and you would expect some return on that. And then take a kid from a really wealthy family in the United States, so a family in the top 1% of earners, and ask, like, what does that family do for their child? And you know, one of the first things they do is they might send them to daycare early on, which has an enormous amount of enrichment. So there's daycares here by Columbia. I used to live at 21 Claremont. And on the ground floor of that is a daycare that I think costs like $35,000 a year, something like that.
Wow.
And that, like, your kid can go there starting at the age of 6 months. And, you know, the people at that daycare are incredible. Like, they have PhDs in early childhood development from mm-hmm. Columbia Teachers College. And they're really wonderful people who are very attentive to the children who go to that school. And, you know, but the difference between the investment that that kid gets and the average six-month-old is huge. I mean, it's just astronomical. And that happens again and again and again. And it doesn't just happen where the child then goes to this, you know, $35,000 J-care for 5 years until they go to suddenly, you know, school here in New York that's probably $40,000 or $45,000 a year, until they go to, you know, a high school that's $50,000 or $60,000 a year, until they go to a college that's $70,000 a year. You know, so you have kids. So, I mean, it's that education, but then there's also, like, tutoring, enrichment classes, trips to Europe and China and other kinds of places that, like enrich them. There's piano lessons, et cetera. The amount that has been invested in those kids is typically just astronomical and compared to, you know, a middle-class kid from a middle-income family anywhere else in the United States. And so one of the things we might ask is, like, are they actually doing that much better? And, you know, as a sort of thought experiment, the answer to me is, like, no, they're not. What's happening is that there's massive levels of inequality, and parents are not being bad people. They're actually doing what most parents want to do, which is investing heavily in their children. But they're investing so much that we kind of have this arms race of investment where those kids end up with so much more than other people. And they're therefore, like, marginally better. They are, like, marginally more qualified.
So I guess this begs the question of, do you think that a meritocracy, a true meritocracy, exists in America?
So, you know, a meritocracy is a strange idea because, like, you know, the idea emerges from really the the word is coined by a British lord who writes about education, who writes a book called The Rise of the Meritocracy. And then he publishes the book under the name Michael Young. And in it, he describes meritocracy as like one of the worst things that could happen. So it's actually written as a sort of dystopian, almost novel, which instead of aristos, the rule by the best, or demos, rule by the people, you have meritocracy. And he uses this to describe like this cold, terrible, evaluative education system that is going to turn us into robots. And funnily, it gets like converted into something better in terms of how we code it. And Nicholas Lemon, who used to be the dean of the journalism school here and now runs the Columbia World Projects, wrote this incredible book called The Big Test, which is an analysis of where it is that the SAT comes from. And, you know, the SAT was seen as this like meritorious instrument. And it emerged really out of the U.S. military and a series of exams that the U.S. military wanted to do in order to kind of diversify the officer corps. And, you know, that test initially was seen as a way to, like, help get rid of the St. Paul's kids at places like Yale and Harvard, by which, you know, they meant, like, you know, not accepting these just happening to be, like, wealthy from the right family kids and creating a much more equitable system of administration. But as I sort of say in the book, like, a meritocracy is just – it's a form of social engineering, because what you're basically doing is you're deciding, like – what is a thing I can use in order to distribute opportunities to people? And so right now, the thing that we use are, you know, grades in high school, as well as your performance on the SAT.
Right. Holistic.
Holistic. Well, yeah. And then we're like, okay, we're going to distribute opportunities on the basis of that. And, you know, what we don't talk about is that the SAT is not a very good predictor of college performance. It's actually only a pretty good predictor of college performance in your first semester. And after that, it's not very good at all. And yet, it's incredibly important. You have all these people. I'm sure you toiled away studying for the SAT. And what's astonishing about it is like that doesn't really predict much. It didn't predict how you're doing here at Columbia. It's not going to predict much in terms of how other people do. And yet, we sort of construct a society around it. And we're like, how you perform on some basic verbal and math skills is going to help us figure out how to distribute opportunities in society. And if you ask yourself, like, what kind of job you want or what kind of, like, economy you're entering into, whether or not that skill set actually applies to the distribution of sort of jobs out there right now, the answer is, like, it doesn't really apply that much.
Well, I guess what's interesting about that is maybe an argument for the SAT would be that it's more equal. And I guess that's the argument that China might use with the Gaokao, which is unlike the U.S., where it is a bit holistic. In China, it's one test.
Yeah,
I guess. Do you think that an argument could be made that that's more fair?
So, I mean, there's lots of context like this. My father's from Pakistan, and in Pakistan, you take like one test, and they distribute school positions on the basis of that. So, when he was going through it, like the top 100 people got into the top medical school, and then the next 100 people got into the next best medical school, and then eventually came engineers, and then came lawyers, and you have this like incredible stratification system where your performance on that one test really matters. You know, the French have a somewhat similar system. You know, the British really gave Pakistan its system. This was like this colonial idea. And we have a lot of information about how these systems work. Like it's not like it's a mystery to us. There are a range of studies that sort of show, and you know, it shouldn't be that surprising to us. Like most tests are not aptitude tests. So, you know, the SAT, our version of this, is called an aptitude test. And yet you can take a course which guarantees to increase your performance. And so how is it possible that we could have courses that increase your performance 300%, I mean 300 points, on a test that like actually tests your aptitude? And as soon as we see that, we begin to realize that it's not actually aptitude we're testing. We're testing something. It's not that we're testing nothing, but that those things can be prepared for. There can be ways to purchase advantages within them, and that certain types of schooling may actually help you perform better on those things. And so in that case, it's like it's not aptitude. It's actually a non-trivial portion of the test is a test about what your social background is.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I'll say also in China, there's a huge growing literature on this. So like, you know, in my own little world of sociology, I think every month I'm asked to review either a paper or a book about China's education system and how this is working out. And the results are a little different than they are in the United States, but they're not totally different. Like the degree to which wealthy party members are able to prepare their kids to do really well on those exams is non-trivial.
Okay. That's really interesting. So I guess if not, then do you have a preferred system of admission to elite schools?
So, I mean, I think the first thing we might ask ourselves is like, why do we have elite schools? And what do elite schools do? And for our Columbia listeners, I'm sorry to say that they probably don't do that much, which is surprising. But there's a series of papers written by Kruger and Dale, economists, Alan Kruger and Stacey Dale, who looked at what the effect of going to an elite school was, and it's really hard to measure this. So one of the things we'd struggle with this is like, what is the difference between selection into a school and then what the school actually does? And I would say, you know, from my perspective, the findings on this are still a little in the air, but it seems to suggest that like the critical thing about a place like Columbia or Harvard or Princeton or Yale is the capacity to get in. And, you know, I had gone to private school starting just before I went to St. Paul. So when I was sort of 12 years old until I graduated from college. But then I went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which is, you know, a public flagship university. And I have to say that, like, the students at Wisconsin were incredible. You know, maybe not on average as prepared or polished as the Columbia students, but like, I think, you know, the differences weren't massive. And we might ask sort of why it is that there are these kinds of elite schools, why it is that there are schools like the Ivy League, which, I mean, you know, when I applied to college, just as a side note, the acceptance rate to the University of Chicago the year I applied was probably around 45 or 50%.
Wow.
And the number of elite schools hasn't really increased, even as the acceptance rate to Harvard in the 1950s for students from St. Paul's was 95%. So like,
I heard that like during that time, students essentially just picked which Harvard, Princeton, like they just.
Yeah. And what's interesting is like during that period in time, it's not like we think about the people who went to Harvard at that time as like dunces, like they just, but like the acceptance rate was super, super high. Yeah. And, you know, there are all kinds of things like ranking systems, which have created massive incentives for places like Columbia and other Ivy League institutions to do two things. One, make sure that there aren't more schools that have the status that we have. And two, create a huge proliferation of applications so that our rejection rate can be high, because that's actually how we sustain ourselves now. And so we sort of like have this incentive to create a small number of super elite schools, which wasn't really the case in the 1950s. There was like, you know, a small number of super elite schools, but there weren't a ton of people who were going to college in the 40s compared to today. And we've had like, you know, thousandfold increase in college attendance with zero increase in the number of schools that we consider to be elite.
But I guess for people who didn't, people not like me and you, people who didn't attend schools like St. Paul's,
mm-hmm.
why should they care about this book? Why should they read it?
So I think, you know, I don't know that they need to read it. It's interesting.
It's a good read.
I try to, you know, in the books that I write, the other book that just came out, which is about Columbia, maybe we'll talk about that some other time.
Absolutely.
You know, I try to write in a way that is not, it's sort of for a high school senior or a college freshman. And not everything I write is like that. Some of the academic stuff is not at all accessible in that way. But because it's really important to me to be part of a broader conversation. And, you know, I think there's a few reasons why they might be interested in reading about it. The first is an attempt to sort of challenge some of the most commonly held understandings of why there is inequality. The second is to pull back the curtain on spaces that maybe a lot of their classmates have gone to. And then a third might also be to think about, and this is something I've heard a lot from students, is like that the book was super useful in helping them understand how to navigate Columbia or how to navigate, you know, other Ivy League institutions, because there's, you know, just such a feeling of this hidden curriculum. And the attempt is to sort of pull back the curtain on that hidden curriculum and sort of say, like, this is what people are doing in order to be successful, which is not that they're smarter than you and have greater skills. It's, you know, this is the kind of dynamic of ease that's at play. And when you feel like an imposter in this place, understand that this is how I think, at least, you know, people who look quote unquote successful doing this are actually sort of performing the success.
So I guess we can finish with one final question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Professor Hirsch and your book, Sexual Citizens. What are you working on now? What do you foresee? Any future projects that you want to talk about?
Yeah, so Jennifer and I are on like a 30-city book tour right now for that book, which is even much more public than Privilege. It's published by, you know, Norton, a big press. And so we're traveling around the country talking about how to think about and address sexual assault on college campuses. And this is a project that was supported by Columbia, the Office of the President. It was a research team of about 30 people. Jennifer and I were part of the ethnographic team. Claude Mellons, who's up at the medical school, co-led the project. And, you know, so I think I'm going to spend about a year with Jennifer sort of going around the country talking about how to understand and really reduce sexual violence on campus. And then I've already started it, but I've been working on a book for about 8 years that got shelved 5 years ago when I started the Sexual Assault Project. And over the next 2 years, I want to finish that book. And it's a history of the city of New York and told through the Astor family. So it's another book about elites. It'll be the last thing I write about elites. And so I'm going to write that. I'm chair of my department right now, and I will no longer be chair as of July 1st, and I can't wait for that. I don't love administration. And I'm really excited to, like, getting back to being a scholar.
Well, I look forward to reading your history of New York when it comes out, and best of luck with touring for Sexual Citizens. I've not read the book yet, but I really do want to soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Professor Khan. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
That's all for today. This episode was produced and edited by Samuel Hyman. It was written, hosted, and produced by William Yuan Yi. You've been listening to Mumble Jumble, a WKCR News production. For more information about our podcast and WKCR News, please visit WKCR.org. Thank you for listening. See you next week.